This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 255 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I created a poll on Twitter the other day that asked where people thought Russell Wilson would finish the 2019 season in fantasy football. You could choose either in the top 12 or outside the top 12. And the results, at least to me, were pretty shocking. Over three quarters of voters think that Russell Wilson will be a top 12 quarterback this year. And I'm not part of that majority. Now, I don't think that's a crazy finish for someone like Russell Wilson. He's talented. He can pick up fantasy points with his legs. And as my Twitter mentions let me know, he's done it before. He's actually done it every single year of his career. And I want to talk about that for a second. I want to talk about the use of previous season fantasy finishes as reasoning for projecting a current season. Because when people had mentioned to me that he's never finished outside the top 12, my answer was that that particular piece of information is irrelevant. Because it is. It's a completely irrelevant piece of information. This isn't to say that past performances don't help project future ones. Historical information allows us to better predict the future. But that historical information has to have some substance to it. Imagine a scenario where you walk into your favorite restaurant. At that restaurant, you always get their chicken sandwich. And every time you eat at that restaurant, the chicken sandwich is delicious AF. So you go to that restaurant one day, and you see that they change the ingredients in the way that they make that chicken sandwich. Should your expectation be that it's still going to be delicious AF? Maybe you trust the kitchen and the chef to make a really good chicken sandwich, so your answer to that is yes. But wouldn't you want to analyze the ingredients and see what the changes actually were to that sandwich? What if they were putting dog food on the chicken sandwich? What if they hired Brian Schottenheimer to make the damn chicken sandwich? The fact that Russell Wilson was the best quarterback in fantasy football 2 years ago matters very little for his 2019 projection. He had a completely different coordinator. He had a completely different offense. In 2017, Russell Wilson's top three receivers and targets were Doug Baldwin, Jimmy Graham, and Paul Richardson. None of them are on the team anymore. His offensive coordinator was Daryl Bevel, who's over in Detroit. Russell Wilson threw the ball 553 times that year. This year, he's got Tyler Lockett as his top option, a high-variance rookie wide receiver, and a bunch of question marks elsewhere. He's got Brian Schottenheimer, a coordinator who helped run the ball at a higher rate than any other team in football last year. And as a result of that philosophy, Wilson threw it 126 fewer times compared to his 2017 campaign. The only constant here is the quarterback. It's Russell Wilson. And in our only sample of Russell Wilson with Brian Schottenheimer, Wilson finishes the QB12 in points per game. The reason he was the QB9 in cumulative points scored at the position was because of injuries to other quarterbacks, like Cam Newton and Mitch Trubisky. And he did all of this with an 8.2% touchdown rate. His touchdown rate wasn't even that far off from Patrick Mahomes, a player everyone is screaming regression at entering the 2019 season. You can't tell me that QB12 is his floor. His realistic floor is irrelevancy, you guys. Now, I talked about the Seahawks on my team-level regression show, and I even mentioned it earlier this week when talking about Russell Wilson himself. But yes, I'm fully expecting the Seahawks to throw the ball more than they did last year. The question really is, how much more? And maybe Schottenheimer surprises us all, and he has Russell Wilson throw the ball over 500 times this year. If that happens, Wilson would see more scrambles, which would also result in a boost in his rushing production. And then he'd also be able to combat the regression in touchdowns a bit more. But even if all this happens, it still wouldn't guarantee Wilson is a QB12. There's a lot of competition at quarterback this season. If you look at last year, Dak Prescott, Jameis Winston, Carson Wentz, and Baker Mayfield all finished behind Wilson in points per game. Kyler Murray and his rushing ability is also now in the NFL. It shouldn't shock anyone if those guys see a jump. Now, of course, other quarterbacks might fall, but the quarterback competition is fierce this year. And I know that we say that quarterback is deep every year, but it's okay to say that it's continued to get deeper. And that objectively, the competition is tougher. And when the competition's tougher, it's just naturally harder to finish as a QB1. That's why I don't think Russell Wilson is some lock to be a QB1 this year, especially under the logic that he's done it before, and therefore he's going to do it again. If you break down the math, and if you think that there's going to be a lot of positive regression in the pass attempts column for Wilson, that's one thing. I can understand that to a degree. The Seahawks might be worse defensively, and hey, maybe Brian Schottenheimer decides to throw the rock a little bit more. I just don't think it's something that's all that bankable, and remember, we're playing probability here. But sure, there's a path to that sort of season or that sort of upside for Russell Wilson. But to just say he's always done this and therefore he's going to do it again, I can't get behind that. Before getting into this week's questions, because this is a mailbag show, I wanted to send another reminder about the FanDuel and RotoGrinders annual MLB single entry series. Over the next 5 weeks, there are single entry contests with $64,000 in total bonus prizes. Each week, a new series begins, and your four best lineups from that week will count toward the total. The person with the four best lineups in a given week will earn a spot in the single entry series championship for a shot at a $10,000 grand prize, and the top four spots each week will all win bonus prizes. To get yourself entered in the single entry series presented by RotoGrinders, go to FanDuel.com or download the FanDuel app. Eligibility restrictions may apply. This first question is from Twitter from @s.cuff. The vast majority of my league listens to the same fantasy podcasts, we're in the same group chats together, and notifications from apps alert everyone of even the most minute news. The days of sleepers are far behind us. What are the market inefficiencies left to exploit in 2019? Yeah, so this is a great question. Honestly, this is why I get tilted when people say strategies don't matter when you just draft the right players, because it's become increasingly more difficult to find an edge with player evaluation. And not only that, but your own player evaluation is going to be wrong. So there's just a lot of variance by only looking at players to target early or sleepers or values later in drafts. But that's why I think that strategy is where you can exploit things a little bit more. Like, don't get me wrong, player evaluation still matters. But strategy is something that's not easily taught. You can't just listen to a podcast and have it easily tell you when the right time to go zero RB is, or when you should draft your quarterbacks in Superflex leagues. Because there's a feel component to some of that, especially in Superflex leagues where there's no consensus ADP and people are going to do some crazy stuff. Like, I give strategy advice all the time on this podcast. So you guys know that. I also have listeners send me teams on Twitter and ask if their approach to a draft was right or wrong based on certain scoring settings. There are plenty of times where I have no idea why the person did what they did strategically. And I know that they're listening to my podcast. And it's just because strategy isn't as easy to implement as something like, take Damian Harris in round 10. And then there's the weekly management side of things as well. As a community, we spend way too much time looking at our drafts and how to handle our drafts. But it's because we have so much time leading up to the draft. There are ways to be better on the waiver wire. And there are ways to exploit things with trades. Those types of things help separate fantasy teams as well. This next question is from @JojoLewis567. JJ, I noticed that your recent draft was wide receiver heavy, especially in the early rounds, and yet on a very recent podcast, you said that the value in this year's draft lies in the running backs. Are you being inconsistent, or am I missing something? So I'm not sure what you mean by, quote, you said that the value in this year's draft lies in running backs. My running back stance has always been that elite running backs are the biggest difference makers in fantasy, and they're typically drafted in the early rounds of drafts. I don't want that to be confused with a specific draft strategy in 2019, or that I never go wide receiver heavy in certain situations. This honestly is sort of what I was just talking about with my previous answer. Flexibility can help give you an edge. When the league format calls for it, I will go wide receiver heavy. I do it a lot. I do it all the time. If there's a league that has three wide receiver spots, a flex, and just two running back spots, and it's full PPR, I'll have no problem going wide receiver heavy when I'm not in the top four, when I don't have a top four pick. If it's a standard league where I'm starting two running backs, two wide receivers, and no flex, then I'll more than likely go running back heavy. The league that you're referring to is an expert mock draft that I participated in that was full PPR, it had three wide receiver spots, but it also had two flex spots. So going with a zero RB look made a lot more sense. And in mock drafts, I just think it's important to give that sort of perspective for the reader or whoever's viewing that draft. Now, I would have taken a similar approach in my normal draft if this was the case, if these were the scoring settings. But it's an added bonus to give readers an approach they might not have thought about. That's why I went as wide receiver heavy as I did in that draft. This next question is from @WardleSamuel. What is the optimal draft strategy when everyone else makes a run on running backs in the first 4 to 5 rounds? Do you follow the run and start reaching for 6th to 7th round running backs in the 4th and 5th round, or do you capitalize on the valuable receivers everyone else is leaving on the board? Now, I swear I didn't put these questions back to back to back on purpose, but I think this is another good example of having a feel for the draft and being flexible, and that giving you some sort of edge. Just to be totally honest with you, these types of questions are really, really hard to answer. Like, I don't know what the run on running backs really looks like here. I don't know what the scoring is. There's just a lot of factors that I don't know in this hypothetical world. But I'll say this. If you look historically at the RB2 to the high-end RB3 range, a lot of times those players don't produce big seasons. And a lot of times, their production becomes replaceable. And it's very rare for me to buy into a run at a position unless there's a clear drop in tier that's about to happen. Like, if I'm getting a running back in a new tier just to get him, I won't force it. There's no reason to force it. But if I know that after that running back, there's going to be a massive, massive drop at the position, maybe I'll force it. It's not like a super flex league, though, where there's only a certain number of quarterback starters to choose from. Like, if there's a run in your super flex league, you have to react in some way and probably reach for a quarterback. But there are tons of running backs, and there are a lot of running backs with upside. So I'd feel okay about getting some later round backs, all while building up wide receiver and getting some value there. This next question is from @PDXTroyBoy. I'm seeing a lot of Dak Prescott is underrated and poised for a big year. Where does he rank in Superflex leagues, and do you see him having a QB1 type of year? Asking for me, because I'm considering trade offers. Thanks, love your show. Thanks, appreciate it. So I'm glad that you mentioned Superflex here, because the way that you view the position is entirely different than a single quarterback league. And it's not just because they're more valuable and that you draft them earlier. In Superflex, you actually do care about the floor-ceiling combo. In a regular league, we're only concerned with that ceiling, because we know that quarterback is replaceable. So I like Dak a lot less in regular redraft than I do in Superflex. We sort of saw the impact that Amari Cooper had on that team and on Dak last year. Before he got there, Dallas had a neutral script pass-to-rush attempt ratio of 1.09. With Amari Cooper, that jumped to 1.47. From weeks 1 through 7, Dak was averaging 29.4 pass attempts and a little over 16 fantasy points per game. Through the rest of the fantasy season, he saw his average points per game rise by 1.5 points, and his pass attempts went up by over 5 per contest. And if you count the Week 17 contest against the Giants in that really weird game, if you remember it, that points per game is significantly higher. I think the one thing that we have to keep in mind with Dak, though, is that he did score 4 rushing touchdowns with Amari Cooper on the team versus 2 without him last year. Those rushing scores could hypothetically regress, but he has scored 6 times on the ground in each of his first 3 seasons, so maybe not. We should just note that it helped his fantasy numbers with Amari Cooper versus without him. To be honest, though, I'm just more concerned with how things changed in the passing department and how the team called plays. And there's also now Kellen Moore coordinating the offense, which gives Dak a little bit more ambiguous upside. So given all of that and how Dak performed throughout his career, I like him in Superflex as a guy with a nice floor, but this ambiguous ceiling of, what if they throw the ball more? Because that could make Dak a 27 or 28 touchdown quarterback. This next question is from @DerekThom. It says, thoughts on trade calculators? What do you do in a situation where you and your potential trade partner are miles apart on players' value? If not calculators or rankings, what would you consider a good point of reference for player values? I think trade calculators are good, especially for Dynasty, where opinions are going to vary a lot more. I don't use them as these like precise tools, but they at least can guide you and a trade partner throughout a trade. But you can also use them to exploit in trades if you want to as well. If you know you're getting a really good deal, but the trade calculator just says that it's a fair trade, send the person that you're trying to trade with a screenshot of the trade calculator. Seriously. It'll give that person more confidence to do the deal. So I think they're fine to use as a point of reference, especially in Dynasty formats. This next one's from @BXCX1. If you had to pick one Niner running back at their current ADP, who are you taking? Tevin Coleman is the pick here, I think, even though his ADP is rising. That's for a reason, though. Every report seems to indicate that he'll be the one back who won't be a healthy scratch each week throughout the season. And I think it makes sense logically. I think he's the best running back in that backfield. And in that area of your draft, your opportunity cost isn't very significant. So I think Coleman's a solid pick for upside, especially given what I've been talking about the 49ers. That backfield, in such a hot mess last year, was 5th best in yards from scrimmage. So Coleman's the top one that I'm drafting, then Matt Breida given cost, and then Jerick McKinnon. This last question is from @CNT26. How do you differentiate Saquon, Zeke, and Christian for first overall pick in drafts? Well, I think you should include Alvin Kamara there as well. But I don't really think that you could go wrong with any of them. My projections have them basically within 15 points of one another. I actually have Ezekiel Elliott first overall because there's a chance that Dallas's offense really takes a step forward this year, and maybe Dak doesn't see the same type of red zone rushing touchdowns that he's typically seen. And if all of that comes together, we're looking at a monster year for Ezekiel Elliott because he does have some positive regression in the touchdown column coming. And then I have Barkley ranked 4th right now because of situation. Like, my projections show Barkley as the RB1. He's a monster. But that projection is also with a pretty maxed out rushing and target share. There's not a ton of room for growth. And with the Giants situation being the worst offensively by far versus the Cowboys, Panthers, and Saints, and with Daniel Jones likely to see some playing time this year, I think there's more risk involved in drafting Saquon Barkley than the other guys in the top 4. And then with McCaffrey and Kamara, I can make arguments either way. So that's currently how I'm handling those four running backs. That's going to do it for today's show, though. Thanks to all of you for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you're on iTunes, please, please do me a favor and leave a rating and review. And you can also find me on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate you. Enjoy your weekend.